Yes, if I ask you to show every atom, instructions said show every atom, that this technically does that, and this doesn't. But I don't get that right. We fall into that level of sophistication. We know there's four bonds to every carbon, but enough hydrogens on the carbons to make it four bonds, and that this suggests carbon. Stearic acid is its name. But you know the way we allow you in biochemistry to change the acid energy to an H energy if you want. So where it says stearic acid here, it could say stearic. Either one you want. I just want you to know they pretty much mean the same thing to a biochemist. Like any typical fatty acid, I think we've accomplished with a typical fatty acid. It has an acid end where it's a carbon.
fatty acid, that when there are double bonds in fatty acids, typically the geometry of those double bonds is a cis geometry, not a trans geometry. The typical fatty acids in nature is what we're trying to describe here, and having to find some of those famous examples. And the typical fatty acid that I'm going to wait until the next couple of examples to explain, involving this smaller Greek letter omega. That's a lowercase Greek omega. That looks like a W. It's a lowercase Greek letter omega. The omega system or omega notation for double bonds for unsaturated. And maybe I'll go to the next one and quit whether it's in this picture or not. I'm moving on now to the polyunsaturated fatty acids. All it takes to be polyunsaturated is more than one double bond, two double bonds, two cross-bond double bonds, and the structure would be enough to make it polyunsaturated. And here's where we really start using the omega families. I've divided the polyunsaturated fatty acids to know into a few members of the omega-6 family, four members of the omega-6 family, and three members of the omega-3 family. The first of these mentioned is in the omega-6 family something called linoleic acid. Linoleic acid. Here's a, well, you can see how to spell that here in the top. And one way I might try to describe it to you at this point is I'd have you draw its structure. And I might tell you that it's 18, 2, delta 9, 12. Just see if you're starting to understand the delta system notation. Could you, if you memorized linoleic acid that way, 18, 2, delta 9, 12, could you draw its structure? Here would be my style, if you can. I'm going to try and get 18 carbons straight across here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. And at one end, I'm going to make it be an acid. I'm kind of stuck in a row. Geometries of those double bonds. I think it's good enough to just show maybe pages like this, where I want both H's on the same face of my chain, rather than one H on the other H, you know, that might suggest to somebody a trans geometry. I don't want to mislead anyone. If anyone's going to read any geometric isomerism into my picture, I want them to see something that's going to assist.
Do you want to start numbering in the
Do you always start numbering to have the carboxyl? So yes, you might want to argue with me once I've described the omega system. Let's get rid of that if it's in the way, because linoleic acid is not in that picture. Linoleic acid is not in that picture. I have to kind of draw it for you here. Yet I do need you to know linoleic acid. So very famous. Sorry, it's not in the picture. Linoleic, you see, you guys want to see what's in the picture. I don't see linoleic acid there. Linoleic acid does allow me to maybe start describing the omega system. Because, actually, that's too many numbers for me to remember when I try to remember what linoleic acid is. What I carry in my mind when I need to know what linoleic acid is, and maybe even draw a structure for you, is I think of it as 18:2 omega 6. People might write it that way, say it the way I said it, 18:2 omega 6. It's in the omega 6 page. And that's less numbers for me to remember. I can draw its structure from that. You see, the omega system is telling me with this number right here how far you have to go from the omega to come to a double bond. The first double bond to come to an omega. It's in the omega 6 family.
Dr. Littleton?
Because I had to go 6 carbons here to get to the first level bond.
Dr. Littleton?
Yes.
Is it in the omega 3 family?
No, it isn't. Linoleic acid is in the omega 6 family.
That's
why did they say it's in the omega
3? Oh, because in the book it looks like that, but.
But
it's linoleic. I was reading it wrong.
It's not in this picture.
Okay. Thank you.
So, if you're still looking at that picture, linoleic acid's in the omega 6 family. Anybody ever says it's in the omega 3 family, I will use something straight up. You're an agent for change now. I was getting ready to explain the omega system a little better. How would it allow me to go ahead and draw the entire structure just knowing how far I have to go to make the omega when I get to that double bond? You see, the omega system only tells you where the first double bond is from the omega end, and that depends on you to know the typical space between it and any additional double bonds after that. There is a typical space that we're starting to see with this example. You might call it a spacing of 3 carbons when you look at the delta system notation. It looks like a spacing of 3 carbons between the double bonds. This spacing right here, however, you can best make sense of that spacing. Maybe the easiest thing is to see a couple of single bonds between double bonds as the typical spacing between double bonds. And if you know that typical spacing and the omega system's designation tells you where the first double bond is from the omega end, you can go ahead and put the remaining double bonds in from there. That's how the omega system works. that both systems explicitly tell you about is that it's as if both systems try to tell you where that number one is, but they approach it from different ends. The delta designation approaches it from this end, and the omega designation approaches that number one from the other. So doesn't it make sense that if I add these six to these 12, those two numbers should add up to the total number of targets? That's a trick to catch on to and make use of. If you have to translate from the delta notation to the omega notation, when it comes to memorizing,
he's just saying if you network from one side and get 12, and you network from the other side and get 6, you know, there's 18 carbons. Right, and then you know it's 18 and 2, you know that the double bond is going to be 2 carbons over.
Here's an example, because I just don't think I heard him from the beginning to end. Okay, for example, this one.
So here's the delta one. You start numbering here to get your 9, right? And then if you do the alpha, or that's also 9 to the 18 carbon. So you count this way to 9. So his thing was saying...
Oh, it's just which direction you're counting.
Yeah, and he was saying that you could figure out if you add the two together, the last one of these, and that one, you can get
right here.
And then it's just the number of double bonds. So it's really just every other one for double bonds. So if it's 18 and 2, for example, you could start here at the 9 and then just go over double bonds. So it's a lot easier than memorizing each one, like, for example, this one. So you know that it's on the 6, and there's 4 of them. So you know it's on the 6 carbon here, and then there's 4 of them, so every other one. And then you know there's 20. So it should be 20 carbons long, start at the 6, and go every other one.
Oh, that's only when it's every other.
Yeah, but he's saying that they're basically always every other in biological.
Okay.
And then, so if you can double check by adding 14 plus 6 to get your 20. So this is the last one. That's kind of what he's saying.
Did you go to partner?
I did.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right, I gotta run to my car for an editing thing.
Do it.
Longer words. find out having them turn into anything else, having them be removed by having them turn into anything else, would help pull this reaction forward. There's a reaction that will change this AMP into an AP. And that's a reaction that you already know, going the other direction, but it's a reversible reaction. It's time that you learn that you go in your direction. What I'm talking about here is AMP reacting with an ATP. And a reaction catalyzed by a kinase is going to involve the reverse transfer of a phosphate from one of these to the other. And you might be guessing pretty easily which one of these donates a phosphate to the other. And coming up with the conclusion that when the ATP donates a phosphate to the AMP, the AMP would be turned into an ATP. And the ATP, yeah, it would become an ATP. See, I shouldn't be the reaction catalyzed by the memory kinase, just going the other direction, you know. When there's a lot of AMP coming from activation of a lot of fatty acids, there's a lot of AMP from this reaction happening. That could cause a reversible reaction to go in the direction that we're using. There's also a reaction that occurs immediately to this product of the activation of the fatty acid. The activation of the fatty acid produces some pyrophosphate. And anytime pyrophosphate forms, expect this to be its immediate change. You see, there's an enzyme called pyrophosphatase that will catalyze the hydrolysis of pyrophosphate and turn it into a couple of separated inorganic phosphates. That would be breaking the high energy bond between the phosphates. That reaction, that hydrolysis of pyrophosphate catalyzed by pyrophosphatase, is exergonic. And I'm describing how energetically it would help the exergonic nature of this reaction would cause it to be very favorable for going forwards. And then the use of the PP sub I in that reaction would cause a lowering of the amount of PP sub I around. And so these two reactions I just described lower the amount of AMP swimming around and lower the amount of pyrophosphate swimming around. And now that there's less of them around, this reaction will find itself oxidation of the fatty acid to get started and using it as fuel. There's a step that costs itself, not just what it is. And you can see right away why you'd say it costs something. This ATP right here is spent when the fatty acid is activated. But they would say, people in these kinds of talents, they would say that the activation of the fatty acid costs two ATPs. Or if instead of counting ATPs, they count how many high-energy phosphate bonds are spent, they would say it costs two high-energy phosphate bonds. And here's what they're thinking. They're thinking that when the ATP breaks, that's breaking one high-energy bond. And then when the PP sub I breaks, that's breaking a second high-energy bond. They would say, therefore, that when you take all of this into account, including this subsequent phase of the pyrophosphate, breaks the ATP all the way down into AMP. It's also has broken two, both of the high energy phosphate bonds from the ATP. And they'd say it has cost us 200 bonds. If you really want to see why they say it costs two ATPs, I think the simplest way for me to explain that to a student is to say, well, that ATP right there. Then when you think about the subsequent phase of the AMP, that's going to cost the second. There's a couple of ways I can rationalize why they might say activation of fatty acid costs two ATPs, two high energy bonds. I was saying that this reaction costs the second ATP. That reaction costs the first ATP, and this happening to the AMP costs the second ATP. Your count's on twice. say it's costing two high energy bonds. I see what you're doing. This reaction is straightening out, I hope. This reaction right here, yes, it does break a high energy bond, but it also makes a high energy bond. So we're kind of staying even in terms of high energy bonds in this reaction. It breaks one and makes one. Okay, that's what it's doing here. Alright. That's the activation of a fatty acid mentioned in learning objective 5. And in this diagram, we've gotten to here, a fatty acyl-CoA. And we're trying to get all the way to here for beta-oxidation of the fatty acids. So there are some more events required. I sort of wrap my mind around the events required still. You see, for beta-oxidation, I need a fatty acyl-CoA in the mitochondrial matrix. And here's a telemetry. Fatty acyl-CoA that we've explained the creation of in the cytosol can indeed go through the outer mitochondrial membrane, no problem, but it cannot go through the inner mitochondrial membrane. This fatty acid, while it's holding on to this CoA that we've found it attached to thus far, cannot go through the inner mitochondrial membrane. What's going to have to happen is this fatty acid's going to have to come off of the CoA that we just talked so much about becoming attached to. And fatty acid then attaches itself to somebody who's allowed to carry it through the mitochondrial membrane. We kind of describe it as a shuttle. And the character that can actually carry the fatty acid through the inner mitochondrial membrane is called carnitine. So the shuttle I'm starting to describe here is called the carnitine shuttle. Carnitine's job is to carry that fatty acyl group or that fatty acid from a CoA out here to a CoA waiting in here. So there's two different CoA in this cell that we're not allowed to fix readily. there's a pool of coenzyme A out here outside the nucleus, and a pool of coenzyme A waiting for here inside the nucleus. And hydrogen has to carry the fatty acid from a CoA outside the matrix to a CoA inside the matrix. The current can show this process. Right here's the doorway that allows the fatty acid holding on to hydrogen to enter the matrix. And then here is the first reaction of the hydrogen shuttle, a reaction that has the fatty acid or fatty acyl group transferred from a CoA outside of the matrix to hydrogen. Then the resulting fatty acid on carnitine can go into the matrix, and then the last reaction of the carnitine shuttle is right here, where the fatty acid leaves the carnitine and carries it into the matrix, and is transferred to a coenzyme A waiting in the matrix. Then we've got fatty acid attached to a CoA in the matrix. That's the starting point. Let's look at the components of the carnitine shuttle a little more carefully. Let's make some note of their names. The enzyme here in the outer mitochondrial membrane that catalyzes the first reaction of the carnitine shuttle is, well, they call it here carnitine palmitoyl transferase 1. As if the fatty acid has to be a palmitic acid, palmitoyl. We refer to a fatty acyl group from palmitic acid, or refers to palmitic acid. There's an alternative name for that enzyme that I prefer, and that is mentioned on page 423, the same page that this figure comes from, on this very same page, your textbook says that this enzyme is also called carnitine acyl transferase 1. And that's the name I like better. Because the fatty acid doesn't have to be palmitic acid. It can be a variety of fatty acids or a variety of acyl groups. So I prefer this more generic name, carnitine acyl transferase, rather than something that's so so whereas their abbreviation for that enzyme is CPT1, my abbreviation for that enzyme is CAT1. And I offer my preferred name within learning objective number 6. Acyl transferase 1. I say CAT 1. CAT1. But if you want, you can use this name too. It's certainly an accepted name. And instead of CAT 1, you would just have to say SPIT 1. That kind of works too. It's kind of fun to say. Certainly, by either name, it would make you think of the carnitine shuttle. I don't think you're going to get that. Certainly, by either name, it would make you think of the carnitine shuttle. CAT1 or CPT1 is going to make you think of the first enzyme of the carnitine shuttle and make you think of this reaction right here where the fatty acid jumps from a coenzyme A outside the matrix to carnitine. Then, this is simply a doorway through the inner mitochondrial membrane. Doorway that allows you to move that membrane into such a selective membrane. They've named it as something with an ASCN, carnitine, acyl carnitine translocase. That ASCN sounds like an enzyme, and I don't really see it as an enzyme. I see it as a doorway. A question is one I don't know the answer to. And that is, how do we end up with two pools of coenzyme A? How did the coenzyme A like mitochondria get there? That's your question. Was it assembled there, or was it assembled outside and somehow got there? I don't know. catalyzed by a dehydrogenase. And then the fourth step here is where coenzyme A, there's already one coenzyme A holding on to carbons 1 and 2. But now a new coenzyme A comes and attaches itself to this beta carbon and breaks that bond right there. Here's where we chop all the carbons from the acid and the fatty acid. Those two carbons are already attached to a coenzyme A. Right back.